Hello, and welcome to Physics Frontiers. This is episode number 46, Wigner's Friend. Show notes can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/46. Show notes include the papers we discuss on this podcast, links to previous episodes, and links to anything we discuss in the podcast, such as books, other articles, and so on. Hey, Randy, what's going on?
Good to hear from you, Jim.
So what are we doing today, Randy?
We are doing a real mind bender. This has come up recently because Wigner's Friend experiment, which was a Gedanken experiment, thought experiment going back to the, I think, 1961, has recently been tested in a kind of an extended scenario. And yeah, it's one of the weirdest quantum physics experiments, I think, out there, with one of the weirdest results. And it started with some of the weirdest physics philosophy I've ever read.
Oh, yeah. I did get you a copy of the mind-body problem, right?
That's right. Remarks on the mind-body question.
I've never really been fond of this particular argument. I first read about it probably in, like, Alistair Ray's book Quantum Physics, which is a popular account of quantum physics. And I apparently went and looked up this paper because I remember reading it in the past. And it probably didn't happen as an undergraduate, definitely didn't happen in graduate school. So it happened after I started reading popular accounts of things. And, you know, when I first read about it, I thought it was weird. Then I read about it in here, and I thought it was weirder. And then I just ignored it.
Well, then my friend Bob, Dr. Robert Zekas, sent me that an article talking about the experimental results of this recent test of this bizarre prediction, and that must have shaken loose some of this old familiarity that you've had with the problem. And I'm really glad because it's perplexing. It'll be fun to talk about.
What did you get from that original article? You probably didn't get to the Freeman-Dyson one. It was completely extraneous.
Which one was the Freeman-Dyson one?
Well, I sent it to you later. It's called Innovation in Physics. It's even earlier. It was in Scientific American. See, that's 1958. And Freeman Dyson just wrote something talking about how physics evolves and stuff like that. And at the very beginning of Wigner's 1962 article in The Scientist Speculates, which is what we're talking about, he references this. So I went and read it just in case there was something really important about it that would show up in our thing. And there wasn't really. I mean, it was interesting enough because it has, you know, a really great Niels Bohr quote, which is, we're all agreed that your theory is crazy. The question that divides us is whether or not it is crazy enough to have a chance of being correct.
And that certainly applies to this Wigner's Friend experiment.
Do you want to tell me how you viewed the way he did this, or do you want me to go over it?
I think maybe I should give you my dodgy and sketchy version, and then you can clarify a bit, because some of it is unclear to me. I mean, the basic idea here is that Wigner presented this concept that if you look at the probability of looking at your friend or having your friend perform a quantum experiment and then tell you the results later, it should be different than it actually is. Apparently, what it all boils down to, if that commentary by Matthew Pusey conveyed this correctly to me in Nature, that was a 2018 article called An Inconsistent Friend. Apparently, even though your friend does an observation on a quantum system, and you'd think at that point that its results would be fully determined and the friend and the experiment would have been finished and fully deterministic, it turns out that that's not true. That even though your friend conducts an experiment and thinks that he's gotten a result already, the probability that you see when you look in on them is that the system is still in superposition. And so it seems as if the friend and the experiment are somehow united in superposition because you still don't know the result. And that's really bizarre. If this Pusey article is correct, then basically what Wigner's saying is that everything in the universe from, you know, even an atom doing an observation on an experiment will have an effect on the wave function, except for a conscious observer. That for some reason, a conscious observer does not play that same role in basically collapsing the wave function, ending with a deterministic result. And he thought that was the least probable explanation for the outcome of the experiment. So is that basically correct? I mean, I remember seeing the two different processes of evaluating the probability of the experiment and then the friend doing the experiment. But apparently when you do that math, it comes up with the wrong probability. And so if you actually can look into that system somehow, and this one of these recent papers shows how to do that, then it gives you the wrong probability result, that it gives you a superposition state, right?
Okay, yeah. So the way Wigner actually put it together, it's a little odd, because the way he was doing it was something like you have the experimenter and the experiment and the person outside of the laboratory. And that person outside can also theoretically make a that's not exactly how Wigner did it. Wigner had just two people in a room, basically. You have two people in a room, you have one atom doing its thing, and you've designed this experiment so that when you actually look at the atom, then you'll either see a flash or you won't see a flash. So they're all timed at like equal intervals. But whichever one you see, the next time you look at it, whatever you see for the last one, you have a 75% chance of seeing the other one the next time. This is supposed to be a quantum event, but this is a very strange sort of wave function. So it probably wasn't realizable at all, ever. You've got that sort of event track going on. And so you can verify that just yourself by doing the experiments over and over and over and, you know, looking at the joint probabilities of each thing. If I see this, what do I see in the next one? And then after that, you basically split the experiment up into two things, where you have one experimenter, Wigner's friend, and the other one, Wigner. And so Wigner's friend measures, say, all the odd intervals, and then Wigner measures all of the even intervals. And even if Wigner's friend tells Wigner that they've done something,
that they've made a determination, right?
Yeah, so Wigner's friend looks at the atom, sees a flash or doesn't, writes it down in his lab notebook or something, and then tells Wigner what's happened. I saw one or I didn't see one, and then Wigner looks at it. You should see the exact same thing. Statistically, it should be the exact same result as you saw previously. What Wigner said, though, was, what if my friend, Wigner's friend, just tells me that he saw the measurement? And he doesn't do anything quantitative with this, really. But what he does say is that now my friend is in this superposition state. So as far as I'm concerned, my friend is in that superposition state. But that can't be because my friend has a consciousness or a soul. Wigner wasn't sure which. And so, you know, if you've got somebody sitting around there with a consciousness, that consciousness just isn't sitting there waiting for me to make a measurement. It's got to still be working, even if my personal view is that everything's in a superposition of states. That's where the weirdness shows up, right? Is that he's saying, okay, my friend is in this superposition of states. And we've seen that before, right? We've talked about Schrodinger's cat. This is the exact same thing. The only difference between Wigner's friend and Schrodinger's cat is that we're really, really sure whatever makes the world, you know, determine a particular thing when we observe something, it has to be true of our friend over there, too, because there's really no difference between us as far as those things are concerned. So in that sense, it's a little bit stronger. We really, really want to say that the friend can't be in a superposition of states. We dislike saying that about the cat, but it's not quite as visceral, right?
Right, because the cat's not sitting there saying, oh, no, I've taken poison, I'm dying, God help me, while you're saying, but you're still in a quantum superposition.
But it is true. I did work out the probabilities. And if you do this, right, work out the probabilities of what happens classically, that is, if, you know, Wigner's friend makes a measurement, tells you about it, and that means the wave function has collapsed and it's in one or the other direction, you get a different set of probabilities, slightly different set of probabilities than if it doesn't collapse and it keeps evolving. You have a difference between this mixture and this mixed state, which are two slightly different things. That's a little bit disconcerting. So what these other guys are talking about in these other two articles are ways to talk about that in a little bit more quantitative a fashion. You know, Wigner's just flying by the seat of his pants while he's talking about this, because really he's talking about what's happening with your soul. He's saying, if you have a soul, if your friend has a soul, not necessarily you, you don't have to have a soul for this, but if your friend has a soul, then he should never be in a superposition of states.
Because we never experience life as a superposition.
That's what we're going to go on and talk about later on, is really whether or not you have a soul. That is what these guys have measured.
No, fortunately, in the subsequent articles that we are going to go over, the next one was Experimental Rejection of Observer Independence in the Quantum World by Proietti et al. That was 2019. And quantum theory cannot consistently describe the use of itself by Fraukiger and Renner in Nature Communications for 2018. And happily, they did abandon all of this philosophical kind of consciousness stuff, trying to like assert the supremacy of consciousness in a special category outside of nature, which Wigner did incessantly, and it really infuriated me the entire time, especially because you can replace Wigner's friend with a computer or any device which measures, right? So you can eliminate this whole idea of the soul right off the bat, and it's just a non-issue because it applies to any system, right? I mean, you're not going to attribute a soul to a measuring system with a computer that's recording the outcome of experiments, right?
Yeah, we don't have to have anything to do with a soul. That was just Wigner's rationale for why you absolutely positively had to know that when Wigner's friend made the measurement, the wave function was going to collapse. So whenever you hear that wave functions do not collapse, then you can read, you do not have a soul. Okay, I'll edit that so it's funnier later on. But we're out of the soul business now. One of these things, the earlier one, the Fraukiger and Renner paper, that one is a thought experiment, and it's sort of the grandfather of the Proietti.
Oh, okay. That's one. I was wondering how they were related because they're so similar.
Yeah. So basically, there's a third person here that we're not talking about, Klaus Bruckner. He's one of the people that wrote that Vienna commentary for the Spooky Action at a Distance episode.
Oh.
He was one of the four people on that comment. But he also wrote, he wrote a paper called A No-Go Theorem for Observer-Independent Facts. In that paper, he theoretically designed the experiment that Proietti actually designed like a year later or something like that, or probably less than a year later because it came out a year later.
Okay, so this is all happening like right now. Like this is like last year's papers and this year's experiment. As a matter of fact, that experimental paper that we're looking at, I think that's still in preprint. I didn't see a journal associated with it, so it's still being peer reviewed, I guess.
Oh, we might have to delay this podcast.
Well, no, let's give them a little, you know, edge, put them ahead of the curve. They'll know all about it when their friends are reading about it in Nature.
I know I've seen something like this, like on PhysOrg or something like that.
Yeah, they've written articles about it.
So that's the genealogy. There's a little bit more between Wigner and Fraukiger and Renner paper, but not that much, really.
You looked at the probability calculations. Is it right to say that the role of the friend observing the outcome of the system, is it right to say that that has no influence on the probabilities? It's as if that never happened? Do you get the same results as if you just observed it yourself?
No.
Oh, so you get a different result. So it changes it somehow.
Now, I think if you were to take Wigner's thought experiment and actually turn it into an experiment, you would verify what Wigner said, right? If you actually took another experimenter and did something like that. And the reason why I say that is because I think a lot of this is going to have to do with decoherence, right? You've got a real human person in one of these experiments rather than the fake observers that we'll talk about later. That person is so complicated, sort of entangled with so many things, that the state will decohere extremely quickly. And by the time somebody says anything to you, everything's going to be determined anyway.
Is that why Matthew Pusey was saying that in order to do a really faithful test of it, that you'd need to have like a quantum computer that was artificially intelligent? Because a quantum computer, I guess, the information is by nature isolated from its environment, and you'd need it to be conscious so that you could test Wigner's precepts.
Yeah, if you want to do something that's sort of trying to talk about consciousness like that directly, first you have to have something that's conscious and not coupled to the rest of the universe, and also probably be small enough. And probably you can't do that. You have so many different things in there that I'm not sure what exactly the problem is going to be.
I'm really dubious about this concept of trying to incorporate the wave function of a person into the wave function of like a quantum system, like an electron that has a superposition of states spinning horizontal and vertical or whatever, right, or up and down. Same thing with Schrodinger's cat. It's like just because the cat is part of a system that has a quantum mechanical event happening doesn't mean that the cat itself is in a quantum superposition state. Like, we can't make a whole object be in like an entangled state, for example. It decoheres instantly.
Yeah, so in the original formulation, it probably doesn't mean anything. And that might make some of the interpretations a little bit strange, because when we talk about this minimal observer, the minimal observer is a beam splitter. Well, I mean, I guess it's a type 1 fusion gate, but, you know, basically it's a beam splitter and some entangled photons. You know, you've got 6 photons in the experiment, not a lot of decoherence, right? But when you have an actual human person observing the things, that person is interacting not only with every atom in his brain, but he's also interacting with every atom in his body and everything else that he's in thermal contact which is, you know, everything from clothes and pencils to air and light. So you just can't really talk about things at that level.
Okay. Maybe we should talk a little bit about that. The experimental setup and experimental rejection of observer independence in the quantum world.
What do we want to talk about in that?
Well, I guess we should talk about the experiment itself because it's a little bit complicated, but it seems like an elegant test of the concept at hand, you know?
Yeah, well, this goes right in hand with a lot of the things we've talked about. We've talked about, just 2 episodes ago, we talked about that spooky action at a distance, which had these giant bell-type experiments. Well, this is a bell-type experiment. The only thing here is that you have these 4 observers, and so rather than in the aspect experiment, I think they switch between polarizations randomly for their polarization filters. And then you get your correlations from that. Here, instead of switching between correlations, at the end, you have 2 experimenters that are either basically accepting the report of Wigner's friend or their own friends, right, who are doing a second experiment inside of a lab or doing their own measurement on that particle.
Right. They increase the sophistication in the Wigner's friend scenario by having 2 external observers, and they call them Alice and Bob. And then each one of those observers has a friend inside of a sealed lab where they're conducting an experiment on these photons coming out of their signal generator. But there's an added twist that there's a signal generator creating, I guess, entangled pairs of photons outside of both labs, but going through each one of the labs so you can detect without interfering with the state of the photon which state it ends up in, I think.
Well, yeah, something like that. So you've got 1 pair of photons going in opposite directions going into each one of those labs. Inside of that lab, there's another pair of photons that are generated.
Okay, but why do they have a half-wave polarizer on one side of that photon pair going into one of the labs?
A half-wave polarizer on one pair, is that the one that they're going to set to 7 pi over 16 or whatever?
I think so. Oh, because that maximizes the discrepancy statistically, right? Okay.
I think you do the same thing in sort of like the aspect experiment when you're choosing what angles to measure at. Because if you're doing everything with the same polarizations in the aspect experiment and the, you know, Bell stuff, then you get completely perfect correlations because everything's starting and ending in the same state. So you have to rotate one of those states, like 7 pi over 16 is in degrees. And that maximizes that SHCH inequality, which is basically the correlation function. It's a little bit different, but it's not that different.
In this case, though, the inequality that they're measuring is called the Clauser-Horn-Shimini-Holt inequality.
Yeah, that's the same thing that we saw in the Quantum Paradoxes book. You can turn that CHSH inequality into a correlation percentage. You can do that. That's, I mean, they're basically the same thing.
It's interesting that what this ends up testing is the 3 assumptions. Locality is one of them, just like in the Bell inequality, right?
Yeah, you do this, and according to Bruckner, there are 4. One is the universal validity of quantum theory, locality, freedom of choice, and universal facts. That is, universal validity of quantum theory is basically you can apply quantum mechanics to any system, like a cat or a PhD student or whatever, right? Locality, I think, had a little bit of a specific interpretation.
Right. And that assumption, it was that their choices don't influence each other's outcomes.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. You know, it's still locality. Whatever happens, happens because of something nearby, right? Not because of something on the other side of the universe, like the other experiment. Then there's the freedom of choice. We ran into that with, I think we ran into locality and freedom of choice in spooky action at a distance. freedom of choice just means whether or not you're choosing to measure what your friend measured in the little box measured, or your own experiment, which is at 45 degrees or whatever, or your interference experiment on the other side, whichever one of those you choose to do, and what the other guy's doing on the other side isn't correlated to your choice. So your choice and his choice aren't correlated. Your choice and his choice are independent. That's all the freedom of choice means. This one is never really satisfied, I think we talked about before, because, you know, there's always something way in the past that's influencing everything now. All of our light cones intersect at some point, right? So you can never be sure that there's not something that's influencing us both at the same time, and therefore our measurements are correlated. And actually, that might be required for this.
That's really hard to imagine, though, that whatever event affected both of us in the distant past would lead us to make correlated choices which we think are uncorrelated.
Yeah, but if we're in a superposition state based on what happened to a chunk of uranium 5,000 years ago, we wouldn't know, right?
Right. We just blithely think that we're independent, free choosing entities and totally unaware that we're mechanistic automatons going about a pre-universal program.
And the last one is universal facts. And that just means that Alice's friend measures the polarization to be vertical, and you measure it, it's going to be vertical as well. I think the idea here is that they're directly testing you, then going to take one of those other three, FL or Q, and try to throw it out the window.
That seems to be the position that the authors favor, is that what the experiment is telling us is that you can experience a different reality than I can, and they're both equally valid.
Yeah.
That's really hard to swallow. I mean, I have an easier time swallowing a violation of free choice or locality than that there's no such thing as objective reality. I mean, without objective reality, there's no science, right?
Well, yeah, that's hard to talk about. But on the other hand, you know, you may have seen all these little references to cubism, which, you know, has nothing to do with Picasso. Cubism is, you know, it's cubism because David Merman is a little bit mercurial. And so he thought it would be funny, probably. It comes from the idea of quantum Bayesianism. How much do you know about interpretations of probability?
I'm vaguely remembering some kind of Bayesian curve. I don't know. It's been a long time. I can't remember anything about it right now.
Yeah, so Bayesianism is the pet probability interpretation of marketing people, especially for big data. If they want to take a whole bunch of your data, analyze it, and get a probability of, if I show you an ad, or find the maximum probability of the ads they have available, if they show it to you, you will buy the thing. This is this sort of interpretation of probability they use. So Bayesianism itself, it's a subjective interpretation of probability that says that probability is not telling you anything about the world. It's telling you about what you know about the world. And it's associated with a particular view of rationality as well, which when I'm reading quantum Bayesianism, I don't get that from it. But Bayesianism, so much so that if you read Popper's, that's a philosophical treatise. Well, that's a big old probability book masquerading as a philosophical treatise on the philosophy of science. That idea, which Popper gave up, is basically that you can use Bayes' rule, which allows you to update probabilities as data comes in, to be exceptionally rational as Spock. That sort of rationality. It's sort of computer rationality. And you can use it to do computer learning things and artificial intelligence and stuff like that. And so basically, it's a view of probability that is correct for many applications of probability, that probability just tells you about your knowledge of the world. It doesn't tell you anything about the world itself.
It allows you to calculate the probabilities based on your limited state of knowledge, but it has nothing to do with the actual system.
It allows you not only to calculate your probabilities, but it allows you with incoming data to update those probabilities, to change them, to be more accurate for the next time you try to make an experiment.
Very nice.
There's nothing wrong with that. That's a perfectly reasonable way to use probability theory, right? But it doesn't really make as much sense when you're saying, well, when I roll a die, what's going to happen? Or when I flip a coin. and so forth and so on. When actual physics shows up, usually you want to go to a frequentist idea, which says, so because there's so much in this that I cannot control, you know, I get variations and so forth and so on, and those variations are, and those variations end up giving me the randomness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also a perfectly valid way to look at most systems, right?
Yeah.
There are two different ways to look at things. One is basically when you have data coming in, and another one is when you're trying to make predictions from first principles. Quantum Bayesianism is slightly different because now it's saying that that wave function is just your knowledge of what's going to happen. But that doesn't make a lot of sense in a lot of cases because, you know, how many people use photodiodes in some way or some other semiconductor system that relies on quantum mechanics? You know, those semiconductors don't give a damn what you think about what's going to happen quantum mechanically. They're always going to do basically the same thing. So something's happening in there, and it's not really based on your knowledge. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but it also is sort of the way a lot of people are moving towards.
I wanted to mention that I was thinking about Robert Griffiths and the consistent history's interpretation of quantum mechanics that we looked at before when I was reading all this. Because I was wondering, does his argument that you have to apply quantum logic and mathematics to the predictions themselves instead of like classical probabilities in order to properly gauge the probabilities in these scenarios? And I did find a statement from him online in one of his papers, which says that he can explain that his system explains Wigner's friend experiment elegantly. But he didn't really talk about it to any length.
Yeah, well, I mean, all of these people that we've mentioned, they all think that consistent history is completely compatible with the experiments and the thought experiments that they've put together. So I think that it probably does, but I'm pretty sure that I don't know enough about it mechanically to make a really good argument for why.
Well, the interesting thing that I noticed when you were describing cubism is that the Griffiths explanation also requires that each part of the system, like the friend and you and the entangled state, each one has to exist within its own framework. And so it's almost like its own framework is very limited to the knowledge which it has and the experiences that it has. And it can't conflate that with the knowledge and experience of Wigner's friend or Wigner, for example. Apparently, it's got that in common with it, that it's like the evolution, I guess, of the state has something to do with its limited exposure to the system, to the larger systems, right?
I was under the impression that things were allowed to be inconsistent except where the systems interacted.
Yes, things are definitely allowed to be inconsistent.
But when things interact, based on something previous, or based on basically the last interaction, it should be in a particular state. But that state is going to be derived quantum mechanically rather than
through classical probabilities.
That's probably how it would be interpreted. In the same way that when he's talking about, say, the Bell-type experiment, you still get the interference patterns. The only issue is that those interference patterns were always going to be there. All the decisions in the universe basically already happened at the end of the last interaction. It's not something that happens right when the two things come together. So everything has to be consistent, but whatever happened afterwards, that's where the randomness is. It's not at the point of measurement. That's sort of what I remember. The projections happened earlier during the history. They didn't happen at the interaction.
One of the things that never came up in any of these papers that I can remember is, and maybe you could clarify this, if you ran basically an experiment that was like a human version, like Wigner intended, where you've got two different labs with two different Wigners and two different Wigner's friends. And like in this experiment, each Wigner is measuring the state, I guess, of the photon within the lab, and he determines that it's in a superposition. And then the friends inside the lab are getting deterministic results out of every measurement, right? And they're going, okay, this is up, this is down, blah, blah, blah. What happens if the friend inside the lab is telling Wigner what the results of each of his experiments is? I mean, that's not going to change his results, right?
I mean, that's the thing that these guys didn't test. Apparently, everybody seems to believe that that's true, but they didn't really test that in this. Everybody seems to say that if the friend somehow tells Wigner what happened, then there's not going to be any interference pattern.
Holy smokes. See, that would be Yeah, that seems really hard to believe.
Yeah, it's especially hard to believe when you're talking about photons, because you don't know how the beam splitter is going to tell the detector what it just saw. So I'm not actually sure how that would work. Well, I guess what you could do, and they didn't do, is in each one of these labs, one photon comes in and then another pair is generated inside of that lab. One of those pairs goes out to Widner, to the left Widner or to the right Widner, the one that's associated with that lab. Then the other one goes down and is making the measurement on the particle, and that's what's creating the superposition of the one photon pair with the other photon. And that's the measurement right there. That thing's creating that superposition, but that's also making the measurement, and the measurement is going in and it's going down to a detector that just basically says, we made the measurement, we made the measurement, we made the measurement. So possibly they could do something where... probably not. They'd have to have some sort of delay line or something. You could take that information and choose which one of the two experiments to do. If you do that, possibly you can show that you don't get the interference patterns. Because they did not talk about how to not get the interference patterns. To get the complete Wigner's friend experience, you have to show both the interference patterns and the non-interference patterns.
Right.
But they didn't. They were just trying to show that there are no universal facts and we're all just figments of somebody else's imagination.
In fairness, what did they say here somewhere? Oh, they disavowed that somewhere in here, which is weird because the title of the paper seems to. Yeah, he says these authors take the approach that universality of quantum theory is in question, that quantum theory cannot be applied to highly complex systems such as the Wigner's friend experiment where a macroscopic observer is running quantum experiments in a straightforward way. So they're on our side where they're saying, you know, you really can't treat a friend as a quantum system that's like part of the wave function of the experiment.
And I think they're doing that for the same reason, is that the macroscopic observer is just so entangled with so many things that there's no way to do that. But, I mean, it would be interesting to see if they could, by using that one photon, the photon that was used to sort of make the measurement in the lab, and then is used to say that the measurement's been taken, so that, you know, they can use the multiplexer and actually take the measurements. If they could use that to basically choose the experiments and see if they still end up with the interference, and that might tell us the rest of the story. That would be as close as you could get in this experiment to the friend reporting what he actually saw.
Yeah, it would be really interesting if it meant nothing, right? If it made no difference. If the friend could be saying, hey, I detected this, and it still didn't matter. I mean, either result would be fascinating.
It would be. Yeah, I don't know how they'd do that. Well, I wouldn't have known how they'd do this in the first place, so it doesn't really matter what I think. They're very, very clever people.
Mm-hmm.
Although, what they're basically saying is that you have no soul. You now have to get in touch with the Scottish University's Physics Alliance. I guess it's Harriet Watt University. I'm sure they'll call me and tell me how wrong I am. The University Grenoble Alps, the Institute for Experimental Physique, and those four places in Scotland, France, and Austria, they're the ones who have your souls. So you have to write them and get them back.
And it's part of an experiment.
That's right. It was all just an experiment. Yeah, they did a really good job on this experiment, and it's a fascinating experiment.
Yeah, I'm wrestling that because, like, this favored view that the popular science press is taking, that, oh my God, they've proven that objective reality is an illusion.
I'm not sure from that MIT Technology Review. I'm really not sure that they read any of this. After having read these papers three times, and then going back and reading that Future of Work article, I'm not completely sure that whoever wrote that, if somebody wrote it and not a computer, actually read it.
They might have read the abstract.
I mean, the article's basically describing Wigner's friend and not the experiment
that they conducted.
They actually conducted.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm not sure about those things. And Pusey, even though I know Pusey's name and I trust Pusey's name, I think he was really opinionated, and I'm not sure if when he was looking at this other paper, he describing that other paper or just trying to use that other paper to describe what he already felt.
He's like, oh yeah, I know that already. One of the other things that did kind of surprise me is that the Bohmian mechanics seems to offer a possible resolution to this inconsistency, right?
Yeah, so one of the things is that if you have that universal wave function, then it's okay. With Bohmian mechanics, since you have that universal wave function on top of the particle, since you split what we're talking about into two things, right? So they're basically two things in the measurement problem in quantum mechanics. And those are, you have the deterministic evolution. You have this continuous deterministic evolution of something, which is that wave function, and then the random observations that are in particular states. And that conflict is why we have the measurement problem, which may just be a philosophical problem. I think that's what all the authors think. Mm-hmm. If you do have something like that...
A universal wave function?
Yeah. That universal wave function is all over already. So now you have to get rid of the locality. That's basically the idea, is that Bohmian mechanics, as interpreted through Bell, has no locality. Then you're still allowed to still have the universal facts at the high level. At the low level, the non-locality from the universal wave function, you know, should allow these things to have correlations. The bouncing over here is related to the bouncing over there or whatever.
Yeah, but isn't the problem that that universal wave function is unknowable?
Yeah, we don't see the universal wave function. And that's the reason why we get the correlations between the things we can look at, even though we don't think there should be any. If that universal wave function wasn't, you know, evolving and oscillating, however it's oscillating, you know, the little particles in the Bohmian view would not be correlated at long distances.
I see.
But since it has those oscillations, they do have those correlations, because the little bumps on the road are all correlated because they're part of the same evolving system.
Yeah, but it's another unprovable assumption.
Yeah, nobody's come up with a way to talk about that directly. And on top of that, you do have to make that qualification that neither de Broglie nor Bohm actually believed their ideas. I mean, they thought they were little toy models that showed that you could make a better model with that same idea, where you have the breakup of the projection postulate and Schrodinger's equation into two separate entities. But nobody's made a better model. They basically played around with the same model and making it more complicated instead.
Yeah, I've never had any luck understanding the nature of the guiding equation. Like, what is it that's got the waves in it?
I've meant to pick up books that are talking all about that, but every time I think about that, you know, the number of books that are sitting there waiting for me to buy them is huge, right? I could go down to papers, but I don't know which papers are good ones and which ones are bad ones and stuff like that. I just don't know where to go or where I'd get the time, because, you know, reading a technical book takes months, right? So it's not something that just you do over the weekend.
Yeah, it's not like reading a romance novel or something. Yeah. Even a paper, even a 10-page paper can be daunting. One thing that caught my eye was looking over my notes here, was that Schrodinger didn't think that there was any kind of problem with a macroscopic system like a cat being in superposition. I guess in superposition for a significant amount of time also, which is mentioned. That's confounding to me, because we've never really seen a macroscopic system in a superposition state, right?
Well, we can get fairly large systems, right? 70, 80 atoms, certainly.
Right. Not like, you know, a person or a cat or a brick or whatever, a room temperature.
I would take that with a grain of salt. I didn't reread that to make sure that that's what he was saying, because I was under the impression that Schrodinger's cat wasn't to show that the cat was in the superposition. It was to show that at some point something had to be a measurement. But the problem was, we don't know how that measurement actually occurred. So when you look at, like, the Quantum Paradoxes book, that's what it's looking at. But just like when people are talking about Wigner's friend here, they were misrepresenting Wigner's friend as saying the conclusion that they wanted, which is the Wigner's friend thought experiment was devised to show everything's going to be in a superposition of states, and then facts are relative to observers. But we just read the thing, right? It was designed to show exactly the opposite. And that was my impression for Schrodinger's cat as well, is that it was designed to show the opposite, that something was going on there, and that something about our knowledge of quantum mechanics was incomplete because we didn't know what was going on there.
Right, because it would be absurd to think of this cat in both states.
That's right. I'd take that as a grain of salt until I actually reread some of those Schrodinger... I've got some of those Schrodinger essays that they were talking about. Those are later than the cat, though, so Schrodinger may have changed his mind after seeing people do a bunch of experiments from what he originally did.
I'm also kind of perplexed that Wigner actually discovered a really fascinating and contemporary result in the most unpalatable philosophical paper that, you know, I've read recently. It seemed almost grossly unscientific to be looking at consciousness and the mind and soul in these really kind of metaphysical terms. And yet, in the midst of all that, he actually did frame an incredibly cogent and perplexing scenario that's kind of torturously difficult to understand and resolve.
Like I said, I mean, it looks like he just rephrased the Schrodinger's cat argument.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And he rephrased it in such a way that it was even more jarring than Schrodinger's cat already was. And that was on purpose because he was trying to talk about the consciousness thing.
Right.
How important our souls are.
Yeah, it's kind of cool that, you know, despite how much I have a distaste for the motivation for the argument, it's a great argument.
It's very interesting that these sort of minimal observers, at least, although it's not really surprising, right? I mean, if you've got the aspect experiment, you'd expect that the way they did this thing is going to work the way it does. You know, yeah, you can say maybe it shouldn't, maybe I feel bad about it working out that way. With the sort of things that they have going on, the reason why they call it a Wigner-Bell test is because it's the same thing as the aspect experiment, only with a couple of extra photons thrown in. So this particular experiment, it would be very surprising if this particular experiment did not give the results it did. I'm a little more worried about their reasoning.
Yeah.
So it's very possible, I think, that the list of assumptions are either wrong or incomplete.
Mm-hmm.
That they've made some other assumptions like causality, for example, that make the list incomplete. Remember, that was what Bell put in. He said universal validity of quantum theory, locality, and causality.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's the aspect experiment.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't get rid of that causality. That's still in there somewhere, but it's not in any of these things.
It's interesting to think about retrocausality and how that might resolve these kind of experiments, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I haven't thought about it at all, but I did just mention it. So you'd mentioned that so that I could put that in the show notes.
That kind of time symmetry, that does seem like it could resolve these kind of paradoxes, right? I guess I'd like to see a retrocausal look at the probabilities here of the Wigner's friend experiment. I wonder if there's anything out there about that.
Almost certainly not. I mean, there aren't that many people doing retrocausality.
Did Isaac Barth bring it up in his book that you recall?
No, not in that. So that book, he wasn't the only person in the book. So he was just explaining the basics of his theory. That did not get anywhere near the level of detail that you'd need to do something like this. It was not that complete. It was just talking about the sort of things we were talking about before, you know, with, you know, the projections and stuff like that. He's still deep in the sort of string theory area where everything's symmetry and so forth.
Well, I guess it's an exciting time because we'll get to see some more work on this and see what some of the most innovative theorists come up with to make sense of this experiment.
But, I mean, I know you don't have a lot to do, so maybe you can do the five-dimensional. Well, I guess it was a six-dimensional version, right? So you can do the six-dimensional version of this and see what that says.
All right, I'll get right on it, Jim.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We'll all appreciate it.
I'll give you my results next week. All right, so are we good?
We haven't talked about everything, but I think we've talked about enough.
Did I miss anything that you wanted to go over?
No. We do have to apologize to Daniela Frotchiker and Renato Redner.
Yeah.
Because
I butchered their names?
No, because we completely skipped over their paper.
Oh, did we? Because I was looking at it the whole time we were talking, and I was kind of – there were so many similarities between the assumptions and what they meant. And we did talk about some of the solutions that they offered with the consistent histories and the Bohmian mechanics. That all came from their paper.
I'll make some commentary on it or something somewhere. Yeah, we don't have to apologize to them. We just didn't do very much with that. And it's okay. I think people are confused enough.
I know I am.
Yeah, we don't have to add in that other paper. That is a long chain of logic that they have to go through.
You did hit the record button on this one, didn't you?
What, you didn't? All right.
All right.
All right. Well, then thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, James. And you have a wonderful week. We'll discuss something fascinating and mind-bending on the next episode of...
What episode are we going to do next?
I was going to say Physics Frontiers.
Physics Frontiers. Oh, that thing. Okay. Yeah. Thanks. See you, Randy.
Thanks, Jim.
Bye now.
See you, everyone.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers number 46, Wigner's Friend. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/46. These show notes will include the papers discussed in this podcast, other papers mentioned in this podcast, books mentioned in this podcast, and so on, including possibly links to supplementary material if I ever complete it. That you've listened this far means you probably like our podcast, And if so, we'd like to ask you to please help us out a little bit on Patreon. So you can go to patreon.com/physicsfrontiers and donate a little bit of money per episode. And depending on the level, you get different things. And of course, we'd be very appreciative if you do. All right. Thank you.